take it as
it
is.
I didn't know how you want it. I just, it's the name and the office.
You want it.
It's fine. It's fine. You're recording already?
Mm-hmm.
No, we're not starting yet. This was a sort of a roll call of famous missionaries. Of course, among the roll call of famous missionaries, perhaps the most famous was David Livingston, who was listed there, and it gave just a sort of a thumbnail sketch of what the different missionaries have done. David Livingston originally planned to go to China, but because of the Boxer Rebellion in 1900, he was not able to go. The door wasn't open, and instead of waiting for the rebellion to be over, he went to Africa and became one of the most famous missionaries there. And if you could read of David Livingston's experience, it's really tremendous. It's how he was able to go into really dangerous territory. Another one that is of this nature, who's over in the eastern part of the world, who went into dangerous country, into New Guinea and some of the Hebrides Islands, was John G. Patton. That is a very thrilling story, to read the biography of John Patton. Have any of you ever read it? It's almost like reading a teenage boy's adventure book story. It's so exciting, of the many things that have happened to John Patton. He was finally killed by the natives, but he spent many years. He was killed in the Hebrides. H-E-B-R-E-D-E-S, I think is how you spell it.
The book I read said something about him, and he was eaten by...
I don't remember if it was John Patton that was eaten or another one that was eaten by cannibals.
Cannibal.
Those are people who eat human meat, who kill people to eat them. In Formosa there used to be. Formosa, in the older times, before the Japanese occupation, there used to be cannibals. But missionaries went among them just the same. Perhaps it's just that in our modern times, we look for an easier way, but people of older times were more willing to pioneer and to go. Anyway, those are just some examples.
I have a book entitled Giants of the Missionary Field.
Alright, that's a good book. That's an excellent book. Giants of the Missionary Field.
Mm-hmm.
If you get a chance to read it, that'd be fine. You have that in here?
Yeah, I've read it. Sarah,
oh, yes, uh-huh. Giants of the Missionary Field by E.M. Harrison. Story of Jonathan Goforth. There's a real man of faith right there. He went into parts of China. In fact, there's one time he went into a place in China where no white man had ever been before and lived. The people were barbarians. It was back up in the western part, up in the mountainous place. They were very much bitter against white men. He went there. And one night, the people even camped around his house, going to kill him that night, but they didn't. Somehow the Lord protected him.
Oh, I read about that in the Chinese book.
Well, Jonathan Goforth, many experiences.
Did he die anyway?
His wife? No, his children. He had two or three children he lost over there. His wife, Rosalind Goforth, has lived to be quite old.
Why?
Because there's several books in the library written by his wife, after she was very old. Rosalind Goforth was his wife. David Livingston, of course, we've commented about him. I never know how to pronounce his first name. Abdoruran? Judson. Anyway, Judson. He was an American missionary. We talked a little bit about him in our other class. He was the first missionary to Burma. And he had some real experiences. Well, let's go back to our lessons that we were taking in this class. We were still on the pagan tribes of the Philippines, and we were taking up the last one that we would discuss, as the Mangyans of Mindoro. These Mangyans are a peculiar group of people, as we already noted. They're peculiar from the other pagan groups because they do believe only in one God, and that he is a spiritual God, and therefore they have no images of him, no idols. They have a written language, which to my eyes looks very much like Sanskrit. They live in little huts. I think I already mentioned that their means of livelihood is by hunting and by growing of sweet potatoes. And they are pagan tribesmen in the sense that they appear and they act like pagan tribesmen culturally, but not religiously. Religiously, I wonder if you can call them pagan, since they believe in one God and that he is a spiritual being. I wonder if they couldn't be actually believing in the same God that we believe. I don't know. There's a situation there. It may be the same God, but they seem to have no particular name for him. They just call him God. That is the word for God in their own language. And their worship is not congregational or anything. It's more or less individualistic. Individual. They don't meet for church services or worship services of any kind. It's just as the individual wants to pray, he can pray, and so on. It's individualistic, perhaps very much like the Oriental religions of China and Japan. Those are individualistic or family type. And theirs is that way. They don't seem to take their religion very seriously. It's not very important to them. They pray for harvest and pray for the game, and most of their prayers are of the give me type, as mentioned in this morning's chapel, practically altogether of that type. In fact, I believe that Christians' prayers are about the only religion that is not of the give me type. Practically every other religion is the give me type, and perhaps too often Christianity is too, and it shouldn't be. It's more of a desire, praying that the gods will give us something, always like that. And so their religion is very much that way. They need Christianity. The Catholics have tried to do a little bit of work among them, but from a distance. They've gone into the main towns where other Filipinos were, and their work has been mostly through charity and trying to put clothes on them. When they come down into the town or into the villages, they give them clothing, used clothing, so that they will have some clothes to wear. But they have not been very successful. When they go around to the Catholic Church to get their hand out for food or something, they will wear their clothes, but as soon as they're outside the gate, they take them off again. And they don't much like to wear clothing, but they do like to wear jewelry. They like to have lots of bracelets, maybe made out of iron or something that's bright and shiny, and necklaces around their necks, lots and lots and lots of them, earrings and anything that's bright and shiny. They just love things like that. It's not exactly jewelry either. It's anything that's shiny. They like. They like to wear it on their person somewhere. Well, that's rather typical of pagan tribes people. Not so much of the northern tribe people of the Philippines, but of the central and southern people. They're very much like that. I suppose Africans are like that too, aren't they? Anything bright and shiny, they like to wear. So, in fact, in South America, the same thing. This missionary equipment service that I have a catalog of, we can buy things cheap. They have in one section equipment for entering among tribes people, where you can buy colored beads, glass beads, and so on that you can use for going in and making friends. You can buy them by the crate from this company. Very unusual culture. Up until a few years ago, there was practically nothing known about these people, and people hadn't been among them. And so an archaeologist, no, I don't suppose you'd call him an archaeologist, maybe sociologist anyway, an American man who was working for his doctor's thesis in that field of sociology, went over to the Philippines and lived among them. Now, this man wasn't a Christian. He was religiously, I don't suppose he was much of anything. I can't think of his name now. It seems to me his name was Collins. I'm not sure. But he lived among these people for 3 years. He lived in their villages, ate their food, slept in their houses, and even dressed like them while he was up there among their people. Of course, when he came down into the lowlands, he dressed with somewhat more clothes, but he never wore a shirt while he was there. When he did come to the lowlands, he wore shorts. But I am told, now I don't know for sure, but I'm told that he even wore their G-strings when he was up there, and that he tried to be just exactly one of their people, to live in every aspect like they did, to learn what he could to write his doctor's thesis. So he wrote a book on their culture, and most of what is known about these people today is from his writings. I suppose he's back in the States now. But anyway, he has revealed to the world a whole lot about the Mayan culture. What has been being done now of the Churches of Christ is practically nothing. As far as I know, the only gospel that's ever been preached to them is by Dennis Allen, who spoke in a home at a birthday party one time. They were having a birthday, and they got together, and Dennis went there and preached to a bunch of them there. And another time, he went to one of their schools. The Philippine government had tried to have a little school among them, and he went there and told them about the Lord in that school. And that's the only thing that's ever been done, and that was not with the intention of starting a new work. It was just that the opportunity was there, and he took the chance to say something. But that was not his purpose for going to start any church. He was just passing through the territory and had a chance and spoke. So as far as Churches of Christ is concerned, nothing has been done of a permanent nature. Something might be able to be done in the schools. In fact, one of the brethren in Mindoro is applying to be a school teacher in one of their little one-room schools. And in those schools, they're not only children, they may have grown folks. Papa and Mama may come along with Junior to go to school to learn Tagalog and English. But of the other missions, there's only one other mission that I know of that's having any work at all, and that's a group called New Tribes Mission, which is a mission group just since the war. They didn't exist before the war, at least not over there they didn't. And they are there now, and they have started a school in the lowlands. They're not up among the people. That is, the school isn't. The people must come down from the mountains to their school. They have some that are boarding students and some that are day students, but mostly boarding students. And so they're working at it through the school, and seem to be having a fair measure of success. Now, their missionaries do go up into the interior occasionally. They make trips up there to, in interest of the schoolwork and in interest of church. But as far as I know, there are no congregations or churches of that particular mission up in the mountains. No, not that I know of. I don't think so. There are Japanese among them, Japanese soldiers of the last war that have never surrendered. They are still hiding out in the mountains. They still think that the war is going on. And they've tried and tried. Various men from Japan, leaders from Japan, have come down there and have tried to get them to come home, but they don't want to come home. They're living just like the Mongans, the same clothing and just living just exactly the way they are. I guess to camouflage or something, to hide their identity, but there's no problem about their identity. They are so different in structure, in skin color. But there's some of them, just a few, very few men.
I thought they had loudspeakers in the newspaper.
Yes, they have gone up into those hills with loudspeakers. Well, what they have done recently, even occasionally, about once a year, there's still a Japanese officer that comes. And he flies in a helicopter over the villages and talks to them in Chinese, Japanese, by a loudspeaker from the helicopter, trying to get them to come out and telling them that they will be taken back home and everything will be all right. But I don't know. I don't know why they don't want to give up. There's one other island where there's some more Japanese, very near to Mindoro, just the next island. I forgot the name of it. But they never surrendered. If they will never come out, there's no problem. But I don't know, they just don't want to do it. And the Mongans are very friendly people, they accept them. They will accept anybody who wants to come. If you want to come and live among them, that's all right, anyone. Well, that's all for the Mongans. How about an approach to them in the way of establishing missions? Suppose that would be what you would like to do. Is to approach groups like that. Among the Churches of Christ, outside of work in Africa, I don't know of any missionaries that are dealing with pagan tribes. Even some in Africa are not doing it. Of course, there's other fields too. There's the whites in Africa, and they're all necessary. But it seems that among pagan tribes, it's the other missions and missionary societies that's doing all the work, while we're reaching the more civilized people. The civilized people need it too. I don't say they don't. I'm working among the civilized people myself. But there's just so many fields, so many places where people are needed. And that's a field, as far as the eastern part of the hemisphere is concerned, practically untouched by our brethren. In fact, it just simply is untouched. What would you do if you were to go among this particular group? Now, this group is different from any of the other pagan tribes, if you can call this a pagan tribe. It's different from any of the others. So the approach will probably be quite different.
Like Paul begins teaching them who this God they worship is.
All right, I think that's a good thing. Start off by Paul did on Mars Hill, except you don't have the disadvantage he had of all of these images. Their God is a little bit like the unknown God. Paul says, this, the one, you know, the altar that was inscribed to an unknown God, he says, this is the God I will tell you about. I think we could start off that way. You could go among them and tell them about that. And then continue on by revealing how that God sent his son, Jesus, maybe a little bit like Peter's message to Cornelius there. Cornelius believed in God too, but he didn't understand about Jesus. And you can go on to show how that God was working out his plan. What about the matter of congregation so on? You know, living among them. Your relationship to the people.
Raise that woman their own kitchen.
I think that's really the best in any field. That is, of course, one of the goals, to raise up a preacher from among themselves. But before you have such a thing, what should be your relationship to them? To live as they live would be very difficult, especially if it's a missionary with a family. It would be nearly impossible for health reasons. However, I don't think that's necessary in their case, because these people are not particular in those things.
Well,
they are so friendly.
Said,
no.
Well, how come if they are that friendly, it's in the Latin religion, isn't it?
Well, no, not very many have been there, because to go up among them is very, to live in the mountains with them is very difficult, very strenuous. The Catholics haven't done much of anything. They don't take Catholicism seriously. They get help from them, and some of them are even so-called baptized by the Catholics, but it doesn't mean a thing to them. It's all it is so they can get something for nothing. You do have to watch that. Keep them from being what we call rice Christians, to prevent that. They're always ready for charity. They like that. But I think it would be possible to live in somewhat more comfortable quarters and to be able to reach them. They are not far, not too far from the cities. However, method of transportation of reaching them is practically nothing. I mean, all I know to do is take off and hike. Just take a walk. We may have to walk a day or two to get to them. It's not many miles if you just figure in miles. It's just a few miles over. They might take a day or two to go because...
Yeah, you have to go this way and dodge the streams and the rapids and so on. And
it's just hard to get up there. You have to do some mountain climbing. Jim Archer and some others have been down with me, and we sort of looked the territory over. We've climbed up even into the mountains and been to some of those villages. And we kind of came to this idea. It would certainly speed things up and make it a lot easier for a missionary to do work if he could have a helicopter. There's a lot of things to consider on a matter like that, but you could sure get around. You could get around a lot of places. In a few minutes, you can be to a place where it might take 2 days to go by foot. And a helicopter would be fine. Of course, you'd have to first go by foot to the place and make sure that there is a clearing. Because in most of these places, it's forest, and there's not enough clearing. Just wherever there's an open space, there might be a house in it. So you would have to make earlier arrangements in each place to clear off a place enough for a helicopter. It doesn't have to be a very big space. A small place is enough. But clear off a space and let them know. Tell the people so that they won't get excited and worry when some strange thing comes flopping down on them. Sort of warn them. Is it what? Very expensive.
Very expensive.
A helicopter?
Uh-huh.
Well, yes, I guess in a way a helicopter would cost about the cheapest two-passenger helicopter would cost about the price of a Buick Deluxe.
What? Around $3,000? Can you get $3,000 to $4,000?
Yeah. The Bell and Howell has a cheap helicopter with a plastic dome on it.
Now, they're part of the
opera. I am told that they are. They are fairly difficult. That you should have a pilot's license on an ordinary type aircraft, rigid wing aircraft, before you can get a helicopter's license.
So it looks like there'd be enough similarity in the operation. I mean, that would be too much to understand.
Well, I don't know either. I don't know anything about it.
I don't think it's the wife to get one because in a way it's short cut, but the fifth investment is that same run out and then broke down.
Well, there's certain regulations for keeping up an aircraft. Before you can have license, you've got to have that thing in perfect condition. They must be checked up after every so many miles. They have to check everything, take even the engine apart, so that the breakdown is very unlikely. Oh yes, there's helicopters all over the Philippines.
I know it, but I'm.
Philippine Airlines has helicopters for their short hops. And even on Mindoro, they've got a helicopter for delivering mail.
They do?
Yes. They deliver mail by helicopter now. And the Meralco has helicopter for line inspection for their power electric line. They fly the helicopter along instead of having a jeep or something underneath.
Wow.
They have their power line inspection. No, they've been having. That's recent, of course, but they have a lot of it. And the Philippine Army has helicopters for spotting huts in their war against the communist dissidents. They fly helicopters around to spot and radio back. Of course, U.S. Air Force has and Navy has plenty of them for rescue and all the purposes. I don't think it'd be too big a problem with flying a helicopter if you had somebody that knew something about it that was authorized to fly one. But of course, that's a pretty big expenditure and a huge investment for such a thing. In the meantime, don't have to worry about that. Just go on foot. We went to one of the little villages at the foot of the mountain. They're not Mayans, but there's a little church there. And we were discussing our plans, thinking, now, wouldn't it be wonderful if there could be a helicopter for mission work here and so on. And we were talking about it just among ourselves. And one of the brethren was sitting there, one of the elders. The next time he got up in church and told the whole church, says, Broadus and Archer are going to start a new helicopter service to our place.
Oh, my
So he's going to put our little village on the map. And just went on and on and on. We had to stop him. He misunderstood us. He thought we were really going to put a helicopter line where people, because their village is isolated, and it takes them, well, just about all day to go about 11 miles to the nearest town. Just about one day to go that far because they're walking. And 11 miles, you could fly it in a helicopter in 11 minutes. That's a problem, too. A little two-passenger helicopter, you just can't carry anything. Well, maybe that's enough for that. Let's go on to the last portion of mission work in the Philippines, and that is the Chinese. Chinese work will have to divide into three because there are three population groups among the Chinese in the Philippines. The three language groups are Amoy, Cantonese, and Mandarin.
Amoy, I'm taking it in order of the largest populations.
Those are the three language groups. First of all, the Amoy. Since this is the majority group, they have about 80-85% of the population, I think, something like that. Very high percentage anyway. And the Amoy group in the Philippines has many Chinatowns, that is, little groups of Chinese people living in their own community. In many different cities, not only in Manila, but many cities, like Davao and Cotabato and Iloilo and Cebu and lots of towns all over the Philippines, cities in the Philippines. They have their own Chinatown, Amoy group. The Amoy people are, well, as far as their livelihood, their business, they are usually...
Phuken.
Yes, Phuken is another name. Sometimes you might
because Amoy is the capital of Phuken, so...
Phukenese or Amoy. Usually we just call them one or the other. This is the name we usually call them, Pekingese. But Amoy is the province, Fujian is the capital. Anyway, it's the same language. There is a slight difference. Just like in Canton, you have slight differences from village to village. You have, even in Cantonese, we have many sub-dialects, but one basic dialect is Canton, so this is the basic dialect. But I think basic dialect's enough for our purposes. Their business is usually hardware, dry goods, export-import, so on, stuff like that. That's what most of them are, and they tend to be a little bit more well-to-do financially than others. They have more money. At least they used to have more even than they do now. And formerly, it was this group, this Fukien or Amoy group, that more or less controlled the largest portion of the trade in the Philippines. Now, I say that's formerly, not so much now because of the Philippine laws that have taken away most of that business from them. But they used to have most of the control. This group is also the oldest Chinese group in the Philippines. They have been there for many, many generations. But because of Philippine government laws, they can't be Philippine citizens. They're still Chinese citizens, although they've been there for hundreds of years, some of them. They're the oldest group. Now, religiously, about the main thing that I noticed religiously among this group of people is Buddhism, mostly Buddhist. Some of the older people are very devout Buddhists, very strict and very devout. However, I didn't see so much of devout Buddhism among the younger people. They don't seem to be so devout. In fact, that is true of all of the Chinese younger people. They don't seem to be devout at much of anything. They're more interested in learning, more interested in money, more interested in things, material things, younger and science and so on. Younger people tend to be like that. But the older people of this group are very devout Buddhists. However, Amoy people, or the Fukienese people, have a tendency of being very, well, they have a trait, a characteristic that makes them very, what's the word I want? They seem to be very sincere all of the time. I don't know, what's the word, losat is what I want in Chinese. They're not as deceptive as some kinds of people might be. That is, and when they say they believe a thing, then you know that they really believe it. Now, they're not all like that, of course. It's not, you can't always say 100% about any group of people, but it seems that many of them are like
that.
They
can trust you.
They can trust you, and you can trust them. Mm-hmm. Yes, they're very trustworthy. And so, they are people also of conviction. They seem to have lots of sincerity and lots of conviction on what they believe. Their beliefs are very definite. They're not usually wishy-washy, you know, this way sometimes and that way sometimes. They're very definite in what they believe. And so churches that have been started have had very good success with them. Success because of their Oh, I can't think of the words yet. Not only financial, of course, they do have financial success. The people are fairly wealthy. Not all of them, but many of them. And success because of their convictions. They are people that are like that. What they believe thoroughly. So their churches have been fairly strong. Among the churches that are there, I don't know if I'm taking it in the right order of their largeness or of their age. Usually their size and age are pretty much in the same order. But as far as I know, the oldest church, maybe it's not the oldest, but I think it may be, Lily can correct me if I'm wrong, is the Presbyterian group. That is what they call the Chinese Evangelical Church. That is, they do not use the name Presbyterian. However, they are Presbyterian in practice. They were formerly known as Presbyterian. And many of their preachers and missionaries have come from the Presbyterian Church. Their practices of sprinkling and so on, many things are identical to Presbyterian. However, they tend to have a little bit more of the evangelical tone than Presbyterians usually have. Presbyterians in our country are usually very, very formal. and not so evangelical. However, there they are more evangelical than Presbyterians here. But they don't call it Presbyterian anymore. It is the Evangelical, the Chinese Evangelical Church. Now, this church is very large, numbering membership of well over 1,000 people in just one congregation. That's just one congregation in Manila. Besides that, they have other congregations and other settlements of this language group of people throughout the Philippines. They have churches in Iloilo and other places. They also have church in Hong Kong and Singapore and many other places. Formosa too. This group is quite large. They are quite successful in their work. They also have a school with it. What was the name of that school? I forgot now. Hope Christian School. Mm-hmm. They have this school, and they have very good teachers, some of them American missionaries, who are teachers, and their standards are very high, very good standards. Then there's an Episcopal work. I think perhaps the Episcopal work is the second oldest. I'm not sure. I'm not sure that it is the second largest, though. Episcopal or Church of England or Anglican, whichever word you want to use, they use usually the word Episcopal over there. And this work is not so much a church. The church doesn't seem to be nearly so large as there is the school. Their main emphasis is in the school and the hospital. They have a hospital too. St. Luke's Hospital and St. I guess the school is also the same name, isn't it? St. Luke's or St. Stephen, yeah. And so their main emphasis seems to be the school and the hospital. As for the church itself, I don't know. Do you know how many members they have at St. Stephen's Church?
St. Stephen.
Yeah, among the Fukien people. In that.
Formerly, they have more than 1,000, and they all go to the United Brethren Church, the Evangelical.
This Evangelical.
And now they have around more than 500.
So they have lost a lot. That has been very evident because even in other language groups, the Episcopal Church seems to be losing ground everywhere. Well, however, they still have a hospital, St. Luke's Hospital.
And the school is
very expensive to go to, and it's not as nice a hospital as the Methodist Hospital in town.
The school has more students than.
And Hope. Mm-hmm. Yes, they do
Hope
have lots
is very
of students.
Great. Before St. Stephen's Street, Hope now is much stricter than they are.
Yes, St. Stephen's used to be a very outstanding school. Whenever there was any sort of a contest or oratorical speeches or anything, that the students of St. Stephen always took the top honors. But now it's becoming the students of Hope that are taking the top honors. And St. Stephen is falling behind on standards.
They are more or less aristocrat schools.
Yeah, they are more snobbish. Lily's cousins used to go to St. Stephen, and then they transferred to Hope. Nieces and nephews. Now they transferred to Hope.
I was raised in St. Stephen.
Uh-huh, that's Lenny's old alma mater. When she was younger, when she was a little girl. What's that, about 30 years ago?
More than that, 40, I think.
Incidentally, Lily's nieces are very, very smart, very intelligent. They have been taking the top honors in Hope School. And in oratorical contests, they've been taking the top honors in the Philippines. One of them anyway, their oldest niece, Priscilla. Well, that's all, I guess, Episcopal. They seem to be dwindling more to the elite class. They're not available to the general public. And then another group, this group I have discussed a little bit in our other class because we ran across them in Singapore. It's a group that many people call them the little flock. They do not have any name. They say we are just Christians after the pattern of the New Testament. And many people call them little flock. However, at their churches, they just say where Christians meet, as sort of the Christians meeting place. is what they will have. It's a translation of it. It's the Christians meeting place. I guess that's the nearest translation I can get. Because they don't believe in any name. They said that all names would only tend to make a denomination out of it, and they don't want to be denominational. This particular group among the Amoy people also number around 1,000 in membership. They are fairly old, I guess about 20, 25 years old, something like that. They are extremely evangelistic, very much so. Everybody is brother and sister rather than Mr. and Mrs. They are sticklers on that usage of the term. I mean, more so than we are. We call everybody brother and sister too, but it's almost a law and a commandment with them.
Very definite. In the church.
Is if church time, you walk by the church door, come on in. You just can't hardly get away from them. You just have to go in to quiet them down.
In the street.
That's just part of their evangelistic way. They are very zealous, extremely zealous people. And they do not cooperate with ministerial associations or anything like that. It says that these are all denominational and we are trying to be undenominational. In efforts to be non-sectarian, perhaps in a way they have become quite sectarian. Maybe somewhat like some of our own brethren have done. We have become, in many places, very sectarian in our efforts to be non-sectarian. And so many of the other churches there look down on all. They just hate them almost because of that. They say they're non-cooperative and so on. However, although they do not recognize any of the other denominations, any of those people as brethren, they won't call them brother. They do recognize us as brethren. They have, in fact, a close communion. A communion is a service that's all together by itself. It is not with the regular worship service. They have an entirely separate meeting for the communion service. And the Christians meet together, and when any of our people are among them, we are invited to have communion with them. But nobody else. So apparently they recognize that we are trying to have also undenominational Christianity. And although we don't quite go to some extremes that they do, we don't quite go along with them on several things. I have learned recently that they have started in foot washing, and we don't do that. But still, they don't excommunicate us because we do not have foot washing. They didn't used to have it either. It's only something that's been started recently in the last few years. A lady from Louisville, Kentucky, taught them how to wash their feet. She's not of the Church of Christ, though. She's, I don't know, what is she? Well, anyhow. That group is quite strong. They have special evangelistic meetings. They don't just have a 2-week meeting once a year. They have a special evangelistic meeting just about every month, maybe every twice a month sometimes. They will have special meetings, and all members of the church are obligated, if this congregation, are obligated to devote a certain amount of time for the church work. Every Christian that is there, if he is able at all, physically able, he is to spend a certain number of hours each week in church work. Maybe that number of hours is spent in house-to-house visitation. Or maybe it's just taking care of the office for whoever might come in. Or it might be being a janitor to sweep up the floors. Or to act as ushers and so on. Every person has a responsibility and a job to do. Well, I wouldn't want to make such a thing a law, but I think the idea is good. Excellent idea to put every person to work. And they take pride in it too. Now some of their people, we've had a few Cantonese who also spoke the Amoy or Phukian dialect. That before we started our work, we're going there. And since the Cantonese work started, they'd like to come over. But because they had duties and responsibilities in this congregation, they were always loyal to that congregation and always loyal to their duties. Even though they recognized that they were trying to do pretty much the same sort of thing. And they would come and worship with us, and they felt very much at ease. There was no criticism of their worshiping with us. And so on, but because they have already a program of activity where they were engaged, where they had a responsibility, therefore they stayed there. Technically, in membership. Now, there was a Chinese lady, a Cantonese lady, who was a member of that church, and she always worshipped on the Lord's Day with us because she felt more at home in the Cantonese language. But because of her responsibilities and duties there, she never changed membership. She always stuck with them because just because of that of their work program. Well, that held her members. It did very good about holding the members. Now she felt, then I think she was really a member of the body of Christ and one of our sisters in the Lord. You know who I'm talking about.
That this is Wong.
No? Wong, yes, that's Ms. Wong too. Well, Ms. Wong has changed membership.
Uh-huh.
She has put membership with us. This is the lady, she's gone to Hong Kong now.
Oh, that one. He don't have any children.
Yes, she has no children.
Uh-huh. This is
You know what it is. Anyhow. Well, then there are a few other small groups among them. For example, Grace Christian School by Evangelicals. I think they're mostly Baptists. They have they don't have a very large church, but they have a large school. A school with very high standards. Grace School. And maybe that's enough for the online. Any questions on them? There are several missionaries, Americans particularly, among them that speak Amoy. Most of them have been formerly missionaries in China that have come out of China because of the war and are there now. And their growth has been tremendous. They've had very fine success in their work in all of this language group. Any work that's been started except the Episcopal, where they are dropping. Perhaps the reason for the Episcopal Church dropping is that their religion is not so much a religion of the heart as it is a religion of outward form. It is made up mostly of certain processions and kneeling at certain times and getting up at certain times, and it's all just a formality. The whole worship service follows rigid forms. They have prayer books. Rather than praying from the heart, they pray from a book, and so on. There's lots of things like that. So perhaps that has been one of the reasons why they have fallen off. The Fukienese people, in fact, most of the people, Cantonese also, they don't see the genuineness. They don't see the reality of it. It seems to be just formality and no real religion, nothing of the heart. So I think that's one of the main reasons they've lost. Our next language group is Cantonese, the group that we are working with. Most of the Cantonese are in Manila. Perhaps the second largest Cantonese group would be in Baguio, but outside of Manila and Baguio cities, there's practically, well, just very few Cantonese anywhere else. Cantonese are also pretty much to themselves in a community of their own. There are individuals scattered throughout the Philippines. I run into them all the time. But their business, their livelihood is mostly grocery, restaurant, and laundry. And they are also laborers. Common laborers, or many of those are Cantonese. And so the bulk of the Cantonese people are not people of means. They do not have very much. They are poorer people. There are a few who are wealthy. In fact, we've got one wealthy family in our congregation now. But the particular wealthy family are not very generous in their giving. Some of the poorest members of the congregation put peso bills in the collection plate, but the richest one put in nickels and dimes, or maybe a 20 centavo piece. It seems rather odd. Like Mr. Doe, you know, the carpenter, Mr. Doe, he always at least one peso, maybe two or three. And he doesn't make very much now. He's an old man. He's the carpenter. But here these people, it's practically millionaires, are coming and putting in about 20 centavos equivalent to about 10 cents. It's odd that way. I guess the love of money is still very much present. But anyhow, the Chinese people generally are not wealthy. Mostly are not. And many from this group are from China. That is, they have escaped from China in the last war, or many since the last war. Some of them just before the communists took Canton, they have fled there. Although there's also many of the second and third generation of older people, so they're kind of mixed up. Some are sort of refugee type and some are older people. Now in religion, the Cantonese people are, well, it's a mixture. There are some Buddhists, some very devout Buddhists also, but many that you could just, well, as far as I can say, just pagan. Because their religion is not any particular thing. It's a mixture of Buddhism, Taoism, and everything else. They worship many, many demons and gods and spirits. or ghosts, if you want to call them that, and the spirits of their ancestors. It's just all a mixture of many, many kinds, all of the Chinese religions blended together. It seems to be the main religion. Just call it pagan if you want to. But many are with no religion, particularly among young people and some of the men. The more religious people, even if it is pagan religion, are women. But many of the men will just say, well, I'm of no religion. And the young people particularly have no religion. But as they don't take any kind of religion seriously.
There's two kinds of characteristics in the Cantonese and the Taiwanese. The Fukinese, when they have money, when they stay there, they dwell there. We call them Oriental Jews. They will stay there for generation and generation.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cantonese, when they get some money, you know, when they get. They're rich, they go back to China and build lots of houses and everything in China.
Yes.
And they still work outside. They still stay in that
place. Right.
Go back, back and forth, you know, to their homeland.
That's right. Cantonese go abroad to make money to send home. The Fukinese go abroad to make money, but they stay there. Wherever they go, they make that their home. Cantonese never stay. Their home is always back in their own province of China.
Mm-hmm.
They're always sending money home. Yes, this is the language of the village in that I speak. Where did I get? Yes, on their religion. I find this to be true. Of course, this is true not only of Cantonese, but others too, that it seems that for many, especially those who say they are of no religion, I would say that they do have a religion. They do have a god that they worship. Maybe the god is not a spiritual being. It's this one. So often this is a problem that I face when I go visiting and invite folks and say, come on out to church Sunday. Well, I can't. I have to work. Well, maybe they're their own boss. I mean, it's not that they're working certain factory hours or anything of that nature. Maybe the type of work they have is their own home industry. They don't have to. They can stop work anytime they want to. The time is altogether their own. They are their own boss, but they have to work. Well, it's just because during that hour they want to make a little more money. In fact, in Baguio City, I talked to one Cantonese man who was a maker of this mien like we have in chow mein. He made that in his home. He had his little home factory that he made that with, and he just did it in any time that he had. And I invited him. That was the reason he gave. He had to keep working to make money for his family. But he says, I will come if you will do this. If you will pay me how much I would make during that hour, I will come to church. That sounds rather surprising. If we'd give him money, pay him to come to church. I didn't pay him anything. He's never come to church either. Because that was in Baguio. I wasn't sure that it was wise for him to go to that church after that anyhow. That church was turning against us. Well, we shall proceed from there. Of course, one reason for that is that living is very hard, it's true, and very expensive for the Chinese due to government regulations.